I'm so happy to be here at Walmer Road Church with you this morning. As Elaine said, my name is Gene, and I'm happy to be here for all kinds of reasons. One of them is that I have such a deep respect and admiration for your pastor. She is really wonderful and courageous, and I hope that you follow her leadership with joy because she has quite a bit to offer. I suspect that your history as a church is often more of a burden to you than a blessing, but it's a blessing to me, and so that's another reason that I really love being here. And the third is that I used to live in this neighborhood. I lived here for several years, and in fact, two of those years, I lived in the apartment building just immediately north of the church at 40 Walmer. And at that time, my girlfriend lived three blocks west of here on Albany, and the quickest way for me to get from my apartment on Walmer to her flat on Albany was to go out the back of that building, hop over the fence, trespass across your parking lot, hop over another fence, and trespass across the parking lot that at that time belonged to the Laredo Convent. And I figured, you know, we're all Christians here. It's probably okay. I never asked permission. But now I thought today I finally have the opportunity to find out if it was okay that I trespass across your parking lot. So is that all right? Because I was thinking it would be a nice benediction to go out after worship and see if I can still hop that fence and had to cross that way. And, you know, but it would have been cool if you'd said, no, we don't want you to do that. I would have been cool with that, too, because I'm talking about the hard work of forgiveness today. And if it was not okay that I trespass across your property, it would at least give you the opportunity to practice some of that hard work of forgiveness. And as I talk about forgiveness today, I want to talk about some of the things that Jesus said while he was on the cross. And I want to give you a little bit of a warning here in advance that when I think of the cross, I think it's important for us to see this as a sacred God event, but I think it's also important for us to see this as a tragic and heartbreaking human event. And in our tribe of the followers of Jesus, I think that many times we are so careful that we want to protect the divinity of Jesus of Nazareth, the identity of Jesus as the Son of God, that we do so sometimes to the neglect of also identifying his humanity and his identity as the Son of Mary. And I think that when we bring that preoccupation to the cross, that we miss a great deal of what the cross was actually about and how it works toward our salvation. And so just be forewarned that I'm going to be looking at the cross from the standpoint of the human Jesus and his friends. And there are other standpoints from which we could look at it, but that's the standpoint that I'm taking today. Now, before we get to the cross, let me tell you a little bit about myself, which will then carry us back to the cross. And frankly, every time I talk about myself, it ends up making me need to go back to the cross. So that's fairly appropriate. But in 2002, I was invited by the Spring Garden Church up near Young and Shepherd to go there and to lead them as their lead pastor. And when I went there, the church had had a previous pastor that had been in place for about 20 years, was very beloved by much of the congregation, and had a wide-ranging reputation. But it had been discovered that during his time there, he had abused his position of trust in some very substantial ways. And so I became the pastor of a church that was hurt and disappointed and angry. And almost immediately upon my arrival, people began coming and knocking at my door to ask, Pastor, what is the vision? What's your vision for this place? And it was as if they thought that if we could just focus on the future and where you're going to take us in the future, we wouldn't need to actually face the pain and the hurt and the disappointment and all of those things that we're feeling now. And I probably would have cooperated with that whole effort, except for the fact I made a terrible mistake. I reread a very good book. And the book that I reread was a book by a German writer named Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This particular book is called Life Together. And very early in the book, about page 20, he makes the point that vision can be extremely destructive to a church. Now, I have to say, that ran counter to almost everything I was hearing and reading. And here's what he said about vision. He said, the problem with vision is that it's usually based in our human perception of what God ought to be doing. And when God doesn't do what we think he ought to be doing, we get angry. And he said, we get angry in three very predictable ways. He said, first, we get angry with other people because we know what God ought to be doing, and those silly people just can't see it. They're not listening to me. They're not cooperating. If those stubborn people would just cooperate with what God is doing, my goodness, this would be heaven on earth. But he said, after a little while, we realize the problem is just not those people. And we begin to get angry at ourselves as leaders. And we say, why can't I be a good enough people to convince this congregation or this community of faith that this is God's vision? If I were better at what I do, this vision would be materializing. And I felt that quite a bit. Elaine, I'm sure you have never, ever felt that. But I felt that quite a bit. And I would be angry at myself. And he said, then the third level of our anger is that we become angry with God. If you gave me this vision, why aren't you making it come true? Where are you? Why isn't the thing that I think is from you materializing? And we become disappointed with God. And, you know, anger is always only the second thing that we feel. We always feel some other emotion first. And we feel that deep disappointment with God. And I was thinking about Jesus on the cross and the things that he said, and it struck me that in many ways, the human Jesus was expressing the same levels of disappointment, the same predictable angers that we can feel when life isn't working out the way that we think it ought to be worked out. And so as I begin with the cross and talking about the idea of forgiveness, it would really be impossible to talk about a Christian view of forgiveness at all without at some point making reference to the prayer of Jesus from the cross when he prayed in Luke chapter 23, verse 34, the very simple prayer, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. The first level of forgiveness that Jesus needed to come to was being able to forgive the people that were doing this terrible thing to him. And it was a terrible thing. The Romans were incredibly creative when it came to killing people they didn't like. They had all different, wonderful ways to kill people. They were the culture that took killing people and made it a spectator sport. The crucifixion, hanging someone on a cross until they were dead, was a particularly cruel form of execution, and it was reserved by the empire for only two classes of people. There were only two kinds of people that could be crucified according to Roman law. They would be slaves or political insurgents. Political revolutionaries. Those were the only two classes of people the Romans executed. And if you read the trial of Jesus, the charges of which he was convicted and for which he was executed were of sedition. That he had been disrupting the people and threatening the empire by claiming to be a king. Jesus was executed as a political prisoner of Rome. We think of that as a profoundly religious event, and the cross has become a symbol of our religious life. But to the people of Jerusalem on the day Jesus died, it was a political event in the death of a political prisoner. And the bizarre thing is that Jesus was innocent. Even the thieves on the cross understood that. One of them said to the other, "You know that we are hanging here because we have done exactly what they claim we have done, but this man is innocent." Jesus didn't deserve it. It was unfair. It was cruel. It was painful. Jesus had every reason and right to be angry. Because what was happening to him is that the brutality, the violence, and the expedience over morality, which was not only typical of the Roman Empire, but has been typical of every human empire before or since, was inflicted upon the body of Jesus. The violence that keeps our culture alive, the violence or the threat of violence that allows us to have so much when so much of the world has so little, that some people talk about building walls to keep them out, that violence was all inflicted and directed on the body of Jesus. He bore our sins in his body. He absorbed the worst that human violence, competitiveness, acquisition, all those things that characterize empire can do to us. And the only response that he made was, "Father, forgive them. They don't understand what they're doing." Now, let's be clear about this. We always like to have a good motive for the spiritual things we do so we want to know that if I behave properly, I'm going to benefit from it. And let's face facts. Jesus did not get happy by forgiving the Romans for executing him or the Jews for participating in the execution. He wasn't one bit happier the moment after he prayed for their forgiveness than he was before he prayed for their forgiveness. That's not what motivated him to do that. Jesus didn't forgive because it was going to give him peace. He either had peace or he didn't have peace. Yeah. Jesus forgave because it was in his nature. Jesus forgave because it was the right thing to do. What's the alternative to forgiving when you're treated unfairly? To continue the cycle of unfair treatment, to continue the cycle of violence and expedience and brutality. History teaches us that some of the greatest oppressors began as those who were oppressed. What happens when we decide that we are treated unfairly and badly and we're angry about that, so we are going to retaliate, we just keep the cycle of hurting each other going. The only way that we can break that cycle is to forgive instead of to retaliate. Jesus understood that. And I think that one of the crucial moments of our salvation, one of the crucial ways that the cross works, is that Jesus looked at human violence and sin and cruelty and said, "I forgive." Jesus said something else from the cross that is counter to my experience, and it's one of the last things he said. He said, "It is finished." But I want to read, I think what he meant by that is maybe better fleshed out in a prayer that he prayed the night before his arrest and execution. It's found in John chapter 17. John chapter 17, verse 4, Jesus prayed to his Father, "I glorified you on earth by finishing the work that you gave me to do." Don't you wish you could say that? I've done everything you gave me to do. Listen, guys, I have trouble when I go to the grocery store getting everything my wife asked me to get. You know my wife, by the way. She's the one I used to hop the fence for to walk three blocks over to Albany, and I'm happy to say she is still with me today. That hop over the fence was worth the risk of either a broken leg or an arrest for trespassing. I've done everything. I finished everything you gave me to do. Actually, Elaine, it was not this fall that I retired. I'm very nearly a year retired now, and I'm very selective about what speaking invitations I take because I'm enjoying this gig called retirement, but I really wanted to be here with you at Walmer. But anyhow, back to the point that I had a pastoral career of about 43 years, and if I'm objective about it, I was fairly successful. I mean, people don't know my name. I had one person tell me once, you know, Gene, you're very famous among a small group of people. So, you know, I'm not one of these people that everybody's heard of, but I had a reasonably successful career, and the whole time I was working, I felt like I wasn't any good at it. I kept thinking to myself, you know, if I could only do this better, maybe I'm not even supposed to be doing this. Maybe I should be doing something else. And I'm saying this, I think people tend to think that a clergy career is somehow different, but guys, a career is a career. You want to be successful. You want to make a difference. You want not only to be appreciated for what you do, but you want to be able to say, I did a good job. And I don't think most people, whatever their field they're in, actually ever feel like we're doing a good job because so few of us are able to say, I've accomplished everything I was given to do. And I've done it well. And certainly in our moral lives, we can't say that. And so after a little while, we become angry not just at other people, when they don't respond to life the way we think they ought to respond to life, but we become angry at our own inability to motivate them to respond the right way. We become angry at the mistakes that we made. Yes, I'm sure that your ex was a jerk. I get that. They probably were a jerk, but were you perfect? And the answer to that question is probably no. And for those of you that have an ex, I know very few divorced people that don't sometimes say to themselves, you know, if I had just done something a little different, I could have saved that. They may not articulate that very much, but within themselves there is this self-recrimination that they didn't do enough or didn't do well enough in order to save the relationship. I certainly knew that as a parent. Oh, I'd get so mad when my kids would be kids. And then I would think, if I were just a better parent, these kids would not be behaving like usual teenagers. By the way, we have a granddaughter. I'll be happy to show you pictures after worship. I just want to inform you that grandchildren are God's reward for not killing your kids when they were teenagers. I see you laughing down here. I'll bet your parents would say the same thing. I think that at some point we have to come to the place where we recognize that in all of history there was only ever one single person who was able to say it's finished. I've done everything that you gave me to do. All the rest of us are going to go to the grave knowing that we didn't get it right all the time. If I compare myself to other people that had my career, I had a pretty good career. I was pretty successful. When I compare myself to my own ideals, it requires a lot of forgiveness. I need to forgive myself. And here's the thing I've noticed working with people. If I'm having trouble forgiving other people, but I'm not able to pull up and look at and deal with the fact that I also failed, I can't let go of my anger at them. Until I can be honest about my own failures, I stay trapped in my anger at those other idiot people who didn't do what they were supposed to do. And so I'm not able to forgive others and really let go of it, really be at peace with what happened, unless I have the emotional and spiritual capacity to examine my own life and forgive it too. And that's harder than forgiving others. The more insecure we are, the less we like to admit, even to ourselves, that we failed to live up to our ideals. And I'm going to tell you one that's even harder to be honest about. And so we come to that dreadful part of the cross that Veronica, is that, did I remember your name right? That Veronica read for us a minute ago, when Jesus said with a loud voice, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, for those of you that are biblical scholars, I do understand that Jesus was quoting Psalm 22. But that doesn't mean he wasn't feeling it. Why was he quoting Psalm 22? Because he was feeling what the psalmist said about experiencing suffering in Psalm 22. He felt forsaken by God. Even though Jesus understood what was happening to him, it hurt, and he was weakened by that hurt, and he felt like God was somehow letting him down or abandoning him. I don't know why it's so hard for people who are Christians to acknowledge that we feel that way sometimes. After the Second World War, there were a lot of Jewish scholars that were trying to understand why God allows suffering. Why? And you can understand that after the Holocaust. They wanted an explanation for where God was when so many of his chosen people were dying in gas chambers. And one of the schools of thought that came out of that Jewish reflection on the Holocaust was called a theodicy of protest. Now, theodicy is a Fancy Nancy word. Do you know who Fancy Nancy is? If you've got grandchildren, you should know who Fancy Nancy is. And she likes to use big words and say that's a fancy way of saying. So theodicy is a fancy way of saying figuring out why God allows suffering. And these Jewish writers said that really, you're never going to figure that out, but that the best way to approach God and suffering is to make a protest to God about that suffering. And they use some biblical examples like the character Job or the prophet Habakkuk. Habakkuk was complaining to God because God was going to invade with Babylon. And God said, don't worry about it. He said, I've got this all in hand because really what's happened here is that Israel has sinned, and so I'm rising up these fierce Babylonian warriors to come take you over, steal your land, take you captive, make you slaves. You know, I'm going to do that for you. Because you need it. And Habakkuk says, wait a minute, you're punishing Israel by sending even worse people to take their stuff? Wait, God, that's not right. Or you think of Job, who experienced such suffering, not because he had done anything wrong, but because God and the devil had a bet. And Job stood up and he said, wait, God, that's not right. And one of these Jewish writers, a very smart man by the name of Eli Feisel, wrote that God has a lot to answer for. And I believe that's true. Fortunately, I believe God's capable of answering, as Job found. But sometimes it's really hard for us to process it when we're disappointed with and therefore angry with God because we know we're not supposed to be. When one of my kids was much more rowdy than the other, he was, I guess the word for that is a chip off the old block. In fact, it was when I would call my father to complain about his grandson that my father explained to me what grandchildren are. And I would pray and pray and pray for this kid. And I had people of faith everywhere I could find praying for this kid. And he kept being a free moral agent in the universe. Go figure. And it put me in a really tense place. Because I was afraid if I got angry at God, he wouldn't answer my prayers. And I was angry because he wasn't answering my prayers. And what do you do then? And the theodicy of protest says, well, you just tell God how you feel. My God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you in this? Frankly, God, I'm disappointed. One of my favorite saints is a medieval nun named Teresa of Avila. And there's a wonderful story about Teresa that one day she was riding out in the countryside on a donkey, and there was a big mud puddle in the road, and she was riding her donkey through the mud puddle when the donkey stumbled and Teresa fell off into the mud. And those who were around her say that she looked up to heaven and said, Lord, if this is how you treat your friends, it's no wonder you have so many enemies. There are times we feel like that. I'm not sure that it's accurate to say that we need to forgive God, because that maybe implies that God has done something wrong, but we need to acknowledge at least that we're angry with him or that we're disappointed with him. And what I find is just like when we are not able to lift up and look at our anger at ourselves, if we feel spiritually bound up so that we're not able to look at our disappointment and anger with God, we're not able to resolve it. I think that at the end of the day, the last word Jesus said on the cross is the word we want to be able to get to, which is, Lord, into your hands I commit my spirit. I just give myself to you. But these layers of anger prevent us from being able to do that, because my layers of anger make me feel like I have to protect myself. And I can't give myself away and protect myself from hurt at the same time. And so the only way I can really come to say, God, I commit myself to you, I give myself into your keeping, is to forgive the other people that have hurt me, to forgive myself for not being able to prevent it, to forgive God for actually allowing there to be human freedom and not just stepping on everyone else's freedom so that I could be comfortable. Or maybe it works in reverse. Maybe if I'm able to really say to God, I really want to give myself to you, maybe that frees me to forgive. Because I know I don't need to protect myself. I'm in God's hands. Now, let's understand something. Let's look at Jesus on the cross and say that God doesn't always protect those whom he loves from harm. But he does love us through the harm. And sometimes that just has to be enough. If you would like to kind of release into God's keeping your hurts and your pains, I'm going to allow you to pray as I pray, a prayer in which we seek the grace to forgive others and ourselves, and even God. And if you would like to join with me in that prayer, that you could just feel free to open your palms to receive from him in your lap. And so, Lord, we come to you because despite all the evidence to the contrary, we really do believe in you. We really do believe you're good. We really do believe you care for us. Father, there are people who hurt us, who stay with us, more present than the person sitting next to us right now, even though it might be years and decades ago that the hurt was inflicted. Father, help us to forgive. We could continue to hate, we could continue to grumble, we could continue to be passive-aggressive with them, we could continue to ignore them, but that would just keep the pain going. Help us to find grace to forgive them. And God, we're kind of disappointed with ourselves too. We really did think we were better than this. And every time we think we've got it all licked, something else comes up and we find ourselves doing the same stupid things in the same stupid ways, and it just frustrates us. It frustrates us to the point that we are embarrassed to come and ask for your forgiveness again. And of course, the problem is not so much that you're not forgiving us, but we're not. Help us. Help us love ourselves the way you love us. Help us get over the messages we've received through life, sometimes through our religion, that we're not supposed to love ourselves. Help us forgive ourselves. And God, while our heads know that you have never wronged us, our hearts don't know that. There have been times when we've been so angry at you, we told you we would stop believing in you if you didn't do something about it. God, you're good, and you love us. When is just too much to take? When we're at the edge and we're angry at the world and angry at the universe and angry at you, help us to know that you are mature enough to absorb our complaint. That you love us enough to listen to our angst. And help us have the confidence to talk to you about it. So that you have the place in our consciousness and in our spirits that would allow us to fully commit ourselves to you even when it all seems unjust and unfair. Lord, who forgives us so freely, forgive our sins as we forgive those who sin against us. Amen.